Race riots racked American cities several times in the 1960s. We can probe whether the term race riot itself is even accurate as we focus in particular on the riots of 1967 in Detroit and Newark and several other cities. The riots rattled the whole country, and President Johnson felt like a federal response was necessary, so he appointed a commission to explore the reasons for the riots and then distance himself from the final report, which pointed to white racism as a major issue. Riots, Report, and Repercussions are examined in the book Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. It is the work of Stephen Gillen, a professor of history at the University of Oklahoma and scholar-in-residence at History, as in the History Channel. His previous books include broad overviews of American history and works on short periods like the 24 hours after President Kennedy's assassination. Stephen Gillen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be with you.
This is more than an anniversary event. I gather that some more recent events inspired you to write this book?
That's right. I was 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, whatever it was, I was thinking about a new book, and I was sitting on my sofa surrounded by books looking. I wanted to do something about 1968. And I'm looking up at the TV, and I'm seeing these riots in Ferguson. So, and there's a lot of references to the Kerner Commission, and I obviously have a teaching history for a long time. I knew what the Kerner Commission was. I never read the Kerner Commission report. And I just got online and I saw that no one had ever written a book about it. So I went to the Library of Congress and then spent a lot of time at the Johnson Library and realized it's a really rich collection. And so for me, there's a clear connection between the study that I was doing then and the events that I was witnessing today.
So let's set some backdrop here. What was happening, particularly in the crime rate over the course of the 1960s?
So there's two things that are going on. First of all, there is a spike in crime, and that gets a lot of people nervous. And then in addition to that, you have anti-war protests that are taking place and growing in intensity, especially by the time you get to 1966 and 1967. And you also have riots, beginning with Harlem in 1964 and every summer. And again, they increased in intensity every summer. So there's a real sense of fear that society was unraveling. In 67, you have these ferocious riots that take place in Newark and in Detroit. Most of Lyndon Johnson's advisors believed he needed to do something. He needed to reestablish his authority. So it was in response to those riots in particular, but really in response to this larger problem, this perception that society was unraveling, that Johnson created the Kerner Commission.
So even before the riots of 1967, I mean, the issues about unrest every summer and the rise in the crime rate had already become an issue in the elections of 1966. What was the outcome there?
That's right. So Johnson wins his massive majority in 1964, and by 1966 he loses as many seats as he gained, and the Democrats lose as many seats as they had gained in 1964. So beginning. Really, it was Barry Goldwater in 64 when he runs for president that he taps into this anxiety, this fear that people have that the Democratic Party and Lyndon Johnson in particular were soft on crime. And by 1966, that becomes a central theme as Republicans campaign for election and allow them to win all those seats. And it just by 1967, this has become the central Republican talking point when it comes to the Johnson administration. And after, while Newark and riot and Detroit were going on, Republicans were blaming it on Lyndon Johnson, blaming it on his liberal policies and some of the Supreme Court cases that appeared, people believed were lenient on people who committed crimes and more restrictive on police. So this is really something. Not only are we witnessing these uprisings in these cities because of all the horrible conditions, But you're also seeing an uprising on the other side, which is, especially among white suburbanites, a fear of crime and the fear of social unrest. And Republicans start tapping into that. And, of course, they've been tapping into it for 50 years now.
Well, I was about to say, it became a factor certainly in the elections of 1968 as well, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. July 12th, 1967 in Newark, New Jersey. What was the starting point for the riots there?
So it was the arrest of an African-American cab driver. There were two completely different reports. The police say that he resisted arrest, so they had to beat him up. Most that's probably fabricated. They bring him to the police station. He clearly is in pain. He gets dragged into the police station. There's a housing project just right across the street. A lot of people saw him. The rumor spread that he had died, that he had died in jail because he was beaten up by the police. So a large crowd gathered. The police did not respond well to the people who had gathered. And then, you know, rocks are thrown, bricks are thrown, and it just expanded and continued to expand for the next couple of days.
All right, and we have other cities to talk about, too. 5 days later, things are going on in Newark still, Detroit, and other cities as well. The book about this is called Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. We'll revisit more of this with Stephen Gillen and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the historian Stephen Gillen, based at the University of Oklahoma. His work also appears at History.com and on History on TV. We don't call it the History Channel anymore, just plain History, as in it's history. We'll figure that out later. He is talking today about his book, Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. The Kerner Commission was appointed by Lyndon Johnson, the president, after the riots of 1967 in Detroit and Newark and other cities to explore the reasons for it. When the commission delivered on a fairly hard-hitting report, Johnson distanced himself from the report. We'll get into what was in the report, why he distanced himself, and what lessons can still be learned as we go through the hour with Stephen Gillen and you. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So we just laid the groundwork for what happened in Newark, New Jersey, and you know, you're right. When you hear about the circumstances of what touched it off in Newark, it sounds a whole lot like what happened in Ferguson and other cities a whole lot more recently.
There is a pattern to many of these, and that was one of the things that the Kerner Commission explored. They looked at dozens of riots that took place in the summer of 1967, and there were clear patterns. And the clearest pattern that ran through disturbances then and now is that they were almost all instigated by some police event, an arrest. Usually it was an arrest, but some police action ignited a spark, and it spread. So it's remarkable to me when you read the summaries of the disturbances that took place in 67 in the Kerner Commission report, and that was the one issue, the one thread and common denominator that ran through most of the disturbances then. And I think if you look what has taken place recently, it's also true now.
So that's how Newark's riots started. When the National Guard left 5 days later, 23 people were dead. And then as the other cities began to have their own situations, were these in response to Newark to show support for the people there, or were they also triggered by local events?
Yeah, no, they were triggered by local events. Maybe there was something about Newark that was somewhat contagious, but all of these disturbances, and they're different in some of their patterns and in the way they took place, but nearly all of them they are in response to local conditions, to persistent problems that the white power structure in these cities had failed to respond to. So they're not directly related to Newark, and they're certainly not done out of solidarity with what's taking place in Newark. It's really designed to address local conditions.
You know, I found myself as I was writing the intro for just talking to you today that I was using the word race riots, and I began to question the use of the term. I mean, when we used the term race riot in the 60s, what did we mean, and has the term changed over time?
That's a great question. So first of all, there's a lot of meaning to the word that you use. So, and I use uprisings, disturbances, and riots interchangeably, but they're actually very different. So if you believe if you call it a riot, what you are assuming is that this is an irrational response to events. There's something irrational about a riot. If you call it an uprising, then what you are assuming is that this is a rational response to conditions that cannot be addressed any other way. There's a lot of meaning to both of those words, and I use them interchangeably, but they're actually very different things.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And so, but when we say race riot, we don't necessarily mean that these are races clashing with each other. I mean,
that's
often
right.
When the term race riot was used in the 60s, it simply meant that black people were in the streets.
That's right. So that's a big change that takes place. Riots that had taken place before the 1960s were clashes between whites and blacks. And it was oftentimes because whites invaded some black neighborhood. It changes in the 1960s, and these are riots where African Americans are essentially destroying their own communities. Some people question whether we even should call it a race riot, which some people just call it an uprising, because it's very different from the riots that we had seen earlier in the century.
So there had been investigations of riots that occurred before these riots in the summer of 1967. Between those investigations and the general media line, was there a general public conclusion drawn?
Yes. And it goes back to this issue of whether it was an uprising or a riot. What all these reports concluded was that there was an instigator. There was one person who would go into a community and stir people up, and then that would produce the riot. So the assumption, like the McCone Commission, for example, which had investigated a riot in Los Angeles, they concluded that overall African Americans in Los Angeles were pretty happy, but there were some outside agitators who came in, stirred people up, and that was the cause of the riot. So essentially, they ignored and denied that there were underlying problems that African Americans were addressing, and where the Kerner Commission takes a very different point of view, and it points out very specifically, and this is a big issue and source of contention between the commission and the White House. Johnson wanted the commission to say the same thing, which is that African Americans are happy with the Great Society, that they're benefiting from it, that their lives are getting better, and there's a handful of agitators, most likely Stokely Carmichael or H. Rock Brown, who would go into the community, stir them up, then a riot would take place. So the Kerner Commission said that wasn't true, that these were all very local riots in response to local circumstances, and they in many ways were a rational response to the conditions that took place, and that the common denominator was the interaction between the police and the local community, and has nothing to do with outside agitators.
Stephen Gillen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book on the 1967 riots in Newark and Detroit and elsewhere and the response to it from the White House in the formation of the Kerner Commission is told in his book, Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. If you have some questions or comments or like to share some of your own perceptions, if you were alive at that point in history. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So the idea of the second part of the title, the subtitle, The Unraveling of American Liberalism, I mean, LBJ won in a landslide in 1964. The Civil Rights Act had passed earlier that year, the Voting Rights Act the next year. But you say the coalition he led after 1964 was fragile.
It was always fragile because it was built on the momentum and sort of this emotional response to Kennedy assassination in 1963. And Johnson clearly defined himself as the person who was going to carry on President Kennedy's legacy. So I think that, to some extent, helps understand his victory in 64. And also, he ran against a weak candidate. So, but what you see happening by 1967 is there's these fault lines that are emerging in American society. And these fault lines you can see on the commission itself, the debates among the commissioners. And there's a generational fault line. Young people are out protesting against the war. And I think the biggest fault line has to do with race. Johnson had built a biracial coalition, but that was becoming increasingly difficult to sustain by 1967. Whites were moving against the Democratic Party. They were responding. The Republicans had come up with this phrase, which Nixon used in 68, called law. You know, they're in favor of law and order.
Right.
And that was appealing to a lot of white suburbanites. So, and I think it is, and all these things come together, the sense that society is unraveling, and people are blaming Lyndon Johnson, they're blaming the liberal policies of the Democratic Party. So Johnson sets up the Kerner Commission in the hopes that it would endorse his Great Society programs and help reforge his coalition. But in the end, it does something very different.
Any commission's work can be guided at the outset by the people you choose as its members. So how did Lyndon Johnson go about picking the membership of the Kerner Commission?
Well, you know, he surprised all of his aides on Thursday. He was giving an address Thursday night, and he came to the White House around 10 o'clock on Thursday morning. He said, "I'm giving this address tonight, and I want to create a presidential commission to look into the riots." And there have been some discussion of this in Congress, but very little in the White House. So the White House had roughly 10 hours to identify the people who are going to be on a commission. So normally when you have a presidential commission like this, there's vetting that goes on for weeks, and there's lists of people's names, and they get crossed off, and others are added. This was just done at the last minute, and Joseph Califano, who was Lyndon Johnson's very competent deputy, was the one who he and Attorney General Ramsey Clark were the ones who picked the people on the commission. The idea was to have people who represented different parts of Johnson's constituency, black and white. That's one condition, the common denominator among the people he chose was that they all needed to support the Vietnam War, or at least not have spoken out against it. And they needed to have supported the civil rights bills laws that you mentioned earlier, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. But beyond that, you had a fairly conservative businessman named Tex Thornton. You had the liberal Republican mayor from New York, John Lindsay. You had Fred Harris, who was from Oklahoma and a close friend of Lyndon Johnson's. Johnson was confident that that the commission would do his bidding, and to keep it in line, he chose the executive director. The commission did not get to choose the executive director. Lyndon Johnson did. His name was David Ginsburg. He was one of these New Deal lawyer and one of the guys. He's the go-to guy for Democratic presidents from the 30s through the 60s. And he chose his deputy director. So Johnson, like he always did, wanted to keep really tight control over the commission, and he thought that he would do that through David Ginsburg and Victor Palmieri, and because he had some loyal people who were on the commission.
So was LBJ thinking that the commission would fade away and make some milquetoasty report and that would be the end of it? Or did he really want some output from it?
No, he said that he wanted them to, you know, follow the facts and challenge the conventional wisdom. He gave this speech to them about, you know, they should, you know, follow the evidence wherever it may lead you. And, you know, this is not about making people feel comfortable. And it was just all a lie. I mean, Johnson never wanted them to really be an independent commission. Johnson assumed that most of the commissioners had full-time jobs. And they would not be actively involved in the commission. They would simply rubber stamp something, and that it would be David Ginsburg who would be steering the commission and doing Johnson's bidding. And it just turned out that when David Ginsburg and many of the commissioners actually traveled to many of these neighborhoods that experienced uprisings, they were not only just disturbed by what they saw and by the sense of outrage among African Americans, they were shocked by how clueless the local governments, primarily white, all white local officials were. So they would go out during the day and talk to local African Americans and hear all their grievances and how those grievances had not been addressed. They would look at the conditions they live in, what their schools are like, and then they would go to sit down with these white city officials, and they're like, you know, everybody's happy in this town. And, you know, some agitators came in and stirred people up, but generally everybody's really happy. We don't have many issues. And they were stunned by that gap. And I think that led them to go in a direction that was not the one that Lyndon Johnson wanted them to go.
Stephen Gillen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian and author of the book on the 1967 riots and the response, Separate and Unequal, the Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. So it wasn't just field work. The commissioners held hearings, too, and J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI himself, was among the first witnesses. That must have been an interesting day or two.
Well, you know, one of the most difficult issues that the commission had to address is this issue of whether or not the disturbances were the result of a conspiracy, where there was a handful of agitators that were going around these different communities. And Johnson was absolutely convinced that that was the case. And he wanted Hoover to say that. And Hoover hated anybody involved in civil rights. And he never separated, distinguished someone like a Martin Luther King from a Stokely Carmichael. They were all communist sympathizers in his mind. So Hoover spent an hour just talking about all the threats to America and all these radical groups that were involved in helping to, how communists are helping to fan some of these riots. But when there is a dramatic moment where John Lindsay had his opportunity to question Hoover, and Hoover would give these long-winded answers to just about every question that involved how evil any of these protests are. And Lindsay asked him point blank, do you have any evidence to prove that these riots are the result of conspiracy? And Hoover answered with one word, no. So the commission, what they struggled with is how do they issue a report that says there's no conspiracy when Lyndon Johnson was just determined to have them say that it was a conspiracy. And in the end, they did the right thing. They did follow the evidence, but that was not what Johnson really wanted them to do.
Well, and in fact, you mentioned the commissioners going out to the field and hearing horror stories from the African-American community about how they were treated and then talking to the white city leaders and getting a very different story. Field, the staffers, too, because there was commissioners and there was staff as well. Staff went out into the field as well, and they produced something you call the straitjacket of facts. What was in there?
Right. So the commission, the way it was set up is there were maybe about a dozen field teams that would go into these areas and just saturated, and they would talk to business leaders, they would talk to local community leaders, they would gather all the statistics they could about housing, education, welfare. They would interview city leaders, and then they would send back these massive reports from each of these cities. And then there was a team of social scientists whose job it was to analyze that data and incorporate it into answering one of Johnson's questions. Johnson asked them to answer three questions: what happened, why did it happen, and how can we prevent it from happening again? And they were supposed to answer the second question. And these field team reports were just devastating.
And we'll get into those in detail on the other side of a break. Okay. The book is called Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. We'll come back and talk more with Stephen Gillen and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll return to The Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Stephen Gillen, historian at the University of Oklahoma, scholar in residence at History, history.com, the History Channel. He's written a book about the 1967 riots in Detroit and Newark and other American cities and the presidential commission created to investigate those, which ultimately concluded white racism was at the heart of it all. The book is called Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. You can join the conversation on The Exchange with thoughts, questions, comments, perhaps memories of that time. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been talking about the straitjacket of facts that staffers were producing, and in city after city, they were finding irrefutable proof of the fact that things were different if you were African-American in these cities.
That's right, and these reports are coming back to Washington, and they're being analyzed by the social scientists. So there's lots of different, this whole commission is like an octopus, lots of different tentacles. The commissioners are holding hearings in Washington, and they're also going out into the field to get their own exposure to these things. Then you had these field teams that were going around from city to city. So you have all this data that's coming from the bottom up. And then you also have commissioners, many of whom had no exposure really to cities or to the plight of African Americans. I mean, Fred Harris, for example, was from Oklahoma, which had a really small African American population, with the exception of Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, Senator Edward Brooke, who from Massachusetts, and John Lindsay, who was the mayor of New York. These other people had. They had very little understanding of what was taking place in the cities. So they were shocked. They were shocked by what they saw, and the reports that were coming in were even more damning. So the commissioners and just came to the conclusion they simply can't endorse Great Society programs. What they found was that the Great Society was having very little impact in the lives of African Americans in the North. Most of that legislation was designed for the South, but in the North, the problems were more complicated, and they had seen very little progress. So that is one of the things, probably the main thing that led them to really break with Johnson and move in the direction of producing a bold report that went far beyond what anything Lyndon Johnson could support.
So eventually the commission came to the term white racism, and how long and how tough a battle was it just to get to that two-word phrase?
You know, it wasn't hard at all. What happened is when the commissioners came back from that first round of seeing many of these cities, that was the one phrase they all could agree on. They all recognized that many of the problems in these urban areas were the result of white neglect, of white abuse. And a lot of this is from city administrators themselves and the city councils. So they all 11 signed on to this idea of white racism. They interpreted it in different ways. So for John Lindsay and Fred Harris, who are the two most liberal members of the commission, that they believed that discovery of white racism meant that they needed to propose a whole series of social programs to address the inequality that was the result of discrimination. But someone like Tex Thornton, for example, and William McCullough and a handful of others, white races, they thought that was enough, that all they really needed to do was establish that white races, they did not want to propose a whole bunch of social programs that had not been tested. And that becomes really the most contentious debates on the commission are over that third question: how do we prevent riots from happening again? That went right up to the last day.
So, as you pointed out, social scientists are working for the commission too, and they came to a more specific conclusion about brutality because they'd found that much of the wrath in the cities focused on the police. What happened to that particular set of findings? Was that ever presented in any of the reports in the commission's either preliminary or final reports?
It was destroyed. The social scientists, for the most part, it's a very measured report that's based on data. There's a final section that was written by someone who really imposed his own radical politics. But still, there was a lot of valuable information in the report. And while the report is called the Harvest of American Racism, so like the commissioners, they recognized that racism was at the heart of it. But they were much more critical of the police and the role that the police played. They said that the riots were rational, and they believe that many of the police were the cause of many of the riots, or either by the way they responded or by not responding the right way, and sometimes made riots worse. And that was simply unacceptable. And David Ginsburg is trying to hold these 11 commissioners together, and this was a non-starter. So he wrote destroy on the copy that was submitted. And no one ever saw it. None of the commissioners saw the report, The Harvest of American Racism. And there's only, I think some of the social scientists have a copy, but there's only two copies that are available to the public. And one is in the David Ginsburg papers at the Library of Congress. The other one is at the Lyndon Johnson Library. But that went even too far for the commission.
I'm going to guess, because of your location, you probably looked at the copy at the Johnson Library.
I saw both. I went to both. I was spending time in both places. So I saw both of them. I wanted to make sure there were no differences.
Mm-hmm.
To see if maybe one had been edited.
Sure.
But they were identical.
So, Stephen, we're talking about in 1960, was it late 67, early 68, when the report, the final report of the commission came out?
Yeah. It was almost 50 years ago. It was March 1st, 1968.
Okay, so we're talking about this conclusion that, like, you know, there's a problem with police departments in the country and how they treat African Americans. And as you read this from a remove of 50 years, I mean, what sort of thoughts percolate through your mind?
Well, it's deja vu all over again. The commission, although it rejected the tougher language and some of the pointed criticism that was in the Harvest of American Racism document, it still is very critical of the police. It still calls for a lot of reforms in the way the police should interact with black communities. And the biggest one is they need to be trained better, and they need to be trained in how to use non-lethal force, and there are various other recommendations. And a lot of police departments put those measures into place, and they were very successful for a long time. And then what happens? I think 9/11 is a big turning point for us, because suddenly there's fear of radical terrorists who might have access to weapons of mass destruction. So police departments now they want tanks. They want all this heavy armament, and there's all this surplus from the war now in Afghanistan and Iraq. So they're buying battle-tested equipment. So the problem now is that police departments are like small military forces, and many of the, I think, and not all, some, but we are returning to pre-1968 in the way many police departments approach the idea of urban unrest.
So the idea that the commission report released on March 1st, which was about the start of primary season back in those days, so Lyndon Johnson, within a month, the end of that month, in fact, had announced he's not running again. Richard Nixon, eyeing the White House on the Republican side, seized upon the report. What did he make of it?
Well, Nixon, this was a gift to Nixon. And at the Nixon Library, there's all these internal memos of aides are writing Nixon about, you know, this report. And essentially, it says this is your opening. This is your way of reestablishing yourself as a, you know, conservative populist, as a tough law and order guy. Nixon had planned to run in 68 as sort of a high-minded foreign policy expert. But his first major speech, which was in March and on national radio, he took aim directly at the Kerner Commission and said that liberals were soft on crime, that the report rewards the rioters and criticizes the police. It helped his campaign. It helped him to redefine himself and to tap into this groundswell of discontent with the Democrats and this belief that they were soft on law and order. So I think Nixon is really far more significant figure than people give him credit for. Because I think he really is the father. He and not Ronald Reagan is the father of the modern Republican Party, because he's the one who learns, teaches the Republican Party how to talk about race and law and order, and to do so in what appears to be a respectable way.
Because you're never talking about black people or mentioning race. You're just saying we need to have law and order in this country, which some people regard as a dog whistle, not so much as a direct statement.
That's right.
The voices of commission members, I have to wonder what would they were saying then or in later years about opportunities that were taken with the report and opportunities that were missed with it.
Well, you know, they got together. There was a big get together in 1992, and there was a lot of pessimism. It was one of the central findings of the commission. I think one of the statements they make that doesn't get enough attention. They said is that these problems are solvable, but we have to have the political will to address them. And what you see happening from 1968 right through 1992 is, and especially today, is that political will has just disappeared. I mean, people are no longer trusting of government. They don't believe that government can solve these social problems. And the coalitions that would be necessary to try to enact some of these things have disappeared. So our whole political universe has shifted to the right. And so the mood in 1992 was very pessimistic. When I was talking to people recently, they think it's even worse. It's just there's almost no hope that in the short run, anyhow, that there'll be any attempt to address these questions. I think we're at a state now where our political leaders deny we even have a race problem. The comment is, we elected an African-American president. Of course, race is no longer an issue in America, which is, I think, completely willfully ignorant. But I think that political will has completely dried up.
You know, people have been talking about the death of New Deal style liberalism for many, many election cycles, at least since the 90s. But it seems like by 1968, things were pretty much wrung out because, I mean, we're nothing like the Great Society has gotten through Congress since before the 66 election, I guess.
That's right. I mean, what happens, the Great Society ends in 1966 when Republicans make major gains in Congress, and it really limits Lyndon Johnson's ability to do anything. Of course, the Vietnam War is drawing more and more resources. So the Great Society dies, and there are moments of inspiration. I mean, Clinton was able to get some things done, not all of it beneficial, but Obama in his second term spoke eloquently about race, and he also, his Justice Department was very aggressive in forcing police departments to address many of the issues that actually the Kerner Commission addressed back in 1968. But you know, they were brief moments, and I don't think. But even then, you know, both Clinton and Obama were limited in what they could do because they had to deal with a very conservative Congress. And now there's not only no desire to address these problems, there's not even a willingness to recognize that problems exist.
And even the president who ordered the Kerner Commission report distanced himself from the report at the time. That was LBJ. The book is called Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism, a really excellent case study of what happened back then and how we dealt with it, and then ultimately how we didn't in a lot of ways. Stephen Gillen is the author. He's at the University of Oklahoma, scholar in residence at history.com. Thanks so much today for joining us, Stephen.